You're listening to Go Fish with Mike Buck on AM 690, The Fishing Answer. This segment is being brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council at wpcouncil.org. Now, troll on in.
Yep, it's actually a twofer. Last week, we got to spend some time with Mark Fitchett. He's a scientist with the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council. Back again today, we're going to talk about some meetings that are coming up, and of course the big council meeting that's coming up as well, and that is wrapped around another Fisher's Forum, which we'll tell you about in a minute. Before we begin on talking about some of the stuff that he does and has done in all of these reports that had to get prepared for these meetings, a couple weeks ago we were talking to Marlo Sabater. And we're talking about, with him, about corner crab and the unique opportunities there might be based on some current stock assessments that would indicate there is a real valuable fishery out there of this special little crab called a corner crab. And then I found out quite interestingly off the air that Mark Fitchett, before he joined the council, was at NOAA, and one of the hats he wore at NOAA was doing this stock assessment on, you guessed it, corner crab. What a cool thing. Small world, isn't it?
Yeah, small world, obscure species. Yeah.
You know, I know a lot of people just, they hear corner crab and they think Kona, and they think couple crabs on the beach. What is a corner crab? What makes them so special?
It's a Kona crab. They come from the family Ranina, which is frog, which means it's called, they look like sort of a, they look like if a Dungeness crab and a frog had a baby, right? Yeah. They have these little small claws with not a lot of meat yield and big strong back legs, and they can dig into the sand. So they're a type of crab similar to, you know, Dungeness crabs, stone crabs, rock crabs, blue crabs. They're all in the same family. Mm-hmm. They're able to bury into the sand like a gopher really fast.
Based on the back legs, right?
On the back legs. Yeah. Those things, you know.
They back into the sand.
Yeah. And I've been, right when I first moved to Hawaii, I got to see them in the wild within just a couple days. I went for a swim way off in the west side. We went swimming and just, you know, snorkeling around, and you could see them coming up, and then as soon as you get near them, you blink and they're gone, right? Because they just bury in the sand so
fast. Now, isn't
that
interesting? Because if you're really good eye with it, I'm not, but you can see the eyes.
Yeah.
And they're just sticking out of the sand, these little eyeballs.
And they can hide those things too. Little puffer fish, we have video of the poor guys' nets. You've probably seen them, and the hoop nets trying to bury themselves, and they're not quite buried. And you put GoPro on the net so you can see the type of depredation, and, you know, the puffers and anything coming by will bite off the eye stalks if they're all the way down, you know.
But, you know, gang, here's an interesting thing. And even though we had a really neat discussion with Marlo Sabater about it, the uniqueness of this would indicate that it's been an overlooked resource for a while, that there actually is a way that there could be a lot of corner crab caught, and it wouldn't, apparently, and you're the stock guy, wouldn't negatively affect the stock.
So what we found, and in many variants of the stock assessment model, no matter what we did, we showed that even though the catch rates have seemingly declined over the years, and then in the early 70s, we have this big spike in catch rate, big spike in catch, because we had boats, large vessels that were fishing off of penguin banks and catching boatloads of them for 2 years. And then, I guess for economic reasons, those operators left or they went to another fishery. And so,
In other words, they might have been pursuing an opportunity.
Yeah.
Not because of a failing situation, but because it's an opportunity.
An opportunity, but also, you know.
But they didn't get replaced.
Yeah. In Kona crab, exactly. So we have highliners that go in and out of a fishery. You know very well by talking to, you know, Ed Watamura and Ray Morioka, when it comes to bottom fishing, there's a knowledge base, right?
Oh,
there are people who know.
Big secrets.
Know how to fish. Yeah. And that's the thing. There's local knowledge in a lot of these fisheries, like bottom fishing and for Kona crabs, that, you know, it would take you years to know how to use the gear correctly in a catch. So they have that going against you if you're trying to develop the fishery, because if you have one highliner leave, who's going to replace him? So if you look at face value, the catch rates, oh yeah, it looks like the fishery declined. But in reality, the fishing efficiency of those who are in the fishery have been declining, and therefore your catcher, and so therefore catch rates, you need at the naked eye, catch rates need to be clearly examined before making assumptions or making assertions on the status of the stock. And we found that the Kona crabs are very productive. They're in limited habitat areas. So,
you got to find sand.
Right. And so as Marlo probably told you, you know, the fishery can withstand some yield, an increase in yield. But at the same time, you don't just want to like say, oh, well, open season and whack them hard. You need to gradually increase fishing capacity, which we really don't have here in Hawaii. And the other thing is the marketability. I mean, Kona crabs, I love them. They're tasty. Mm-hmm. And so I grew up eating blue crabs back in North Carolina.
Very similar, right?
And so it takes work, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So a lot of people, when you do a crab boil, if you're back in, let's say, in North Carolina or even here in Hawaii and you're doing a crab boil, it's a multi-hour ordeal. You got to cook them. You got to pick them. Yeah. You got to go drink some beers. Yeah. It's a lot of work. So I think...
And it's messy.
It's messy. I don't know if the market has been... is in place here, if the demand, you know, if tourists from Oklahoma are going to come over to Maui and want to eat Kona crab. I mean, there's not that, you know.
There are some that say there would be, if you created the right atmosphere, that there would be a sustainable business for somebody that knew what they were doing. But, you know, there's another side to it. And from what I understand, and I've only been Kona crab fishing a couple times, and to me it wasn't very efficient because it was a bunch of regular flat nets, you know, and on a string, and you were limited to how to deploy them. You had to put bait in them, and you didn't always catch stuff with them.
Yeah,
so, I mean, it's a big leap of faith to go looking for those things,
and especially in it's funny is they're called Kona crab, and if you know anything about the Kona coast, is you don't have this really expanding flat sandy bottom. You got rocks. It can be just hell, you know, setting gear. So Nathan Abe, who I went fishing with and who I've become friends with over the last few years, we went out on his boat to learn how the fishery operates. He puts daisy chains of, say, 10 or 12 nets. And some folks in Kauai or folks who fished off Molokai, Maui, Penguin Banks area may put a daisy chain of hundreds of nets. So even the way they fish for them island to island is different. And so that also needs to be considered when you're looking at catch rates.
And by the way, when you put these things out, you got to pick them right up.
It's a lot of freaking work.
A lot of work,
It's a lot of work. You got to know how to set the gear. There's a lot of local knowledge there. And then once you get the crabs, what's next? And so, you know, with Samoan crabs and Kona crabs, it's good for big parties, right? It's it's like, you know, if you're going to me, I would love to go get a cooler full of Kona crabs and watch a UH game on TV and drink beer. You know, like that would be fun. But I don't think that marketability is in place yet. But I think it's an interesting species. Biologically, they're very fascinating as well.
Well, I know moms don't like it as much as dads.
Yeah.
And I know that particularly that there's a bunch of kids around, mom's looking at a mess. And, you know, it is a messy day. But they say the proof's in the eating. If you catch a good, you know, you get good crab, it's worth all the work.
Yeah.
But interestingly enough, from what I understand, and the reason why it wouldn't turn into a viable fishery is it's just too much work, like you said.
It's a lot of work. You know, but I think there is the ceremonial aspect. There is, I mean, let's face it, you know, if you've had a good crab boil, a good sat down with picnic tables with newspaper on the table, and then
and a big old bib.
And a big bib and a cool full beer and some fixins and eat it and make it a multi-hour affair, I think it'd be awesome. So,
you know, for those that don't know it, it's a very simple deal. I mean, you catch them and you stick them in the hot water and you're done.
Yeah,
you know, pretty much.
And I've been in Taiwan. When I was in Taiwan a couple of years ago, when I first, you know, they call them spanner crabs or frog crabs out there. They fry them up. They actually cook them. They'll fry them up, and then you pick them after you fry them too. Deaf people eat them a different way wherever you are, but they're pretty tasty.
How did you do the stock assessment? I mean, what was the science, and why were you able to sign off by saying that there was a a nice supply of Kona crabs.
Well, I think it came down to data filtering. Mm-hmm. I think that was the big component. We're dealing with state record data. I think at face value, as I mentioned earlier, if you're just looking at catch rate, mm-hmm. you're going to say, oh, well, the fishery's in decline. I think yeah. the prior assessment was done by a young lady who's a great person, but she was given advice to start the assessment starting at the peak. And so mm-hmm. all you see is this precipitous decline in catch rate. So we looked at the entire time series from the late 50s. Mm-hmm. We're able to look at records and look at vessel effects. So you have fisher effects. And to take that into consideration yeah. and standardizing catch rates mm-hmm. to come up with an index of abundance. And there's also the issue with catch, too. So we have a lot of unreported catch, and so we looked at prior studies.
That's really a good point, gang. Here's the reason why sometimes we need to reach out when it comes to that, because anecdotally, all of these guys will tell you it is scientific what they can see and grab their hands on, but there's a tremendous amount of information out there. It could be nobody was fishing because there was bad weather. It could be who knows what, but a whole year might be all of a sudden there was no Kona crab. And you think, wait a minute, there had to have been Kona crab.
Yeah.
There was. They just didn't catch it.
They didn't
now,
catch
it. Does that mean there's going to be more next year because they didn't catch as much this year? We don't know that.
Yeah. And there's, so like looking at the catchability of vessel effects and highliner effects needed to be taken into consideration as well. There are a lot of confounding factors that mm-hmm. we were able to go through and filter out. Because that's all go. Yeah. So, you know, you can run these sophisticated stock assessment models, but what it boils down to is interpreting the data
yeah.
the very yeah. rudimentary base level. And talking to fishermen, cooperating with them, how much discards do we expect? Yeah. There are some studies gone that have been done that suggest the amount of discards in bottom fish fisheries and nearshore yeah. fisheries. So we use that to sort of come up with best is a series of best case scenarios of catch.
What makes, first of all, you know, you're an expert at this, to make it so taste so good. A lot of people get concerned about what crabs eat before we eat crabs, because they're sort of a vacuum cleaner on the shore, on the bottom. Right?
Yeah.
They're not eating fresh stuff.
And that's yeah. a good, and that's, you know, it's funny. Yeah. And we had this conversation with some folks on the Big Island when we were eating them one time, and they're deep water, you know, they're in the deeper water areas. Mm-hmm. So they don't have, they're not subjected to a lot of the muck that, let's say,
I was gonna say
mud yeah. crabs and blue crabs.
Yeah, the garbage they eat is better garbage than the other yeah. crabs eat. Right?
But, you know, sometimes, you know, when I was in Miami, these folks used to take these land crabs. Mm-hmm. And I forget what they're called for the life of me, but these land crabs are everywhere in Miami and in Puerto Rico. So in Puerto Rico, what they used to do is they used to catch them. They'd be in a yard. They'd mm-hmm. be, you know, just swimming around the beach or walking around the beach. And they were eating a lot of garbage and stuff. So yeah. what they used to do is they used to get the crabs, stick them in tires, mm-hmm. and feed them corn and hose them off every day to clean them out.
Oh, my.
So within 2 days, they've
yeah.
already evacuated yeah. a lot of yeah. the nasty yeah. stuff yeah. And those things were yeah. absolutely delicious.
Yeah. It is unbelievable. I mean, there are whole groups that won't eat them at all.
Yeah.
I mean, they're religiously against them. But the point is, whether or not you are going to make a business plan and decide to go become a Kona crab guy, we got a lot of stuff to cover, so I want to move on. But there would be, if somebody really set their mind to it, they could do a pretty decent job of feeding their family by getting good at Kona crabbing.
They could, yeah. But like I mentioned before, you know, there's a local knowledge, mm-hmm. and so, you know, it's a lot of work. Learning yeah. how to fish for them is tough, and that, you know, it commands respect. A lot of these folks, yeah. like Nathan Abe, for yeah, example,
sure.
who's fishing in Kona, knows how to set these nets without mm-hmm. having them wrapped around rocks.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is pretty
yeah.
impressive.
And by the way, to have them sitting upright.
Yeah.
And remember, these are not these things can see, and they can get out of these nets. So it depends how long you leave them in them, how many are dropping. You know, it's not a real efficient way to catch things.
Not always, yeah, but yeah, those yeah. things, those crabs, they are pretty active.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was pretty crazy. We saw the GoPro footage, and it was just like the zombie movie when the zombies come up out of the ground, you know, they come out from the graveyard. We had this video that Cassie Pardee put up with the Kona crab net and the GoPro, and then within a minute, you see all these eye stalks and crabs just emerging from the sand and then coming on the eating the bait, and it was pretty cool to watch.
But you know, you also have to. Isn't it some things that won't eat them? I mean, it won't eat the bait.
Yeah.
It'll eat the crabs.
Yeah.
You know. Anyway, it's an interesting field. I wanted to make sure though that we're talking at an opportune time because we'll take Mark Fitch's hat off for that and move into more important things. A couple of big international meetings held here in Honolulu. I mean, and also we got the big Fisher Forum coming up. What are some of the reports that you were responsible to disseminate or at these meetings that have implications outside of Hawaii?
So, you know, one of my duties working at council, and then also we were talking about Eric Kingma earlier when he was here working with us. One of my duties was to go, and still is, to go to scientific committee meetings. I'm a delegate for the United States on the Science Advisory Committee for the IATTC and the EPO.
Which is?
Which is the Inter-American Tropical Tuna Commission. Their Science Advisory Committee met earlier in May, and I was a delegate for the U.S. and sat in on those meetings and reported back here to Honolulu. Savin Fogner and I were, Savin's worked with the Hawaii Longline Association. He was there as well. And then I'm also on the science committee for the WCPFC, which is the Western Central Pacific
Fisheries
Commission.
That's the one, and that's with a lot of close ties to us, of course.
Yeah, it's a lot of close ties. So that's where the rubber hits the road for the most part for our fisheries management from the science component. That meeting is going to be held in Pohnpei, Micronesia. That's August, I think August 8th to the 20th, or the 12th to the 20th, I'll be going to that meeting as well, and we're preparing for that.
By the way, I love it there. The minute you go across and out the reef, fish. As soon as you get outside the reef, big fish right there.
Yeah.
Big fish.
I'm looking forward to some diving there.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, beautiful.
Yeah, and so we have the commission meeting, the science committee meeting there. And then we have the commission meetings. I will not be attending the IATTC meeting, which is going to be in Spain, of all places. They're going to have the Eastern Pacific. And then the commission meeting in December is going to be in Papua New Guinea.
Okay.
So I think I'll be going to that one as well. But the big ones are the Science Committee and Science Advisory Committee meetings. So at the we at the council, we have in just under 2 weeks, we have the Science and Statistical Committee meeting.
That's here in Honolulu.
That's going to be here in Honolulu. Right. The 8th and the 19th is when I'll be presenting, working some of the outcomes from the IATTC meeting, as well as some fisheries issues and some scientific reports. And then the following week is the council meeting.
Yeah.
So that's when we meet in front of the council.
You will see some releases and some stories on those meetings. But the ones you are sure to find out more about, this is why we want you to go to wccouncil.org. Okay, wccouncil.org. WPCouncil.org.
Yeah.
Please erase what you just wrote and wrote wpcouncil.org. At the tail end of that, there's also going to be a Fisher's Forum. And you are certainly welcome to do that. It's going to be from 6 to 9 at night. At the beautiful Ala Moana Hotel, and that's going to be, I believe, on the 25th?
Yeah, it's going to be on the 25th, so that'll be after, that'll be Tuesday, and that'll be after the first day of the council meeting. Yeah. The council meeting will be the 25th to the 27th of June.
Yeah, and we're going to be disseminating, there's going to be a neat panel. We'll tell you more about that in the weeks to come, but I think leading up to that is sometimes we don't relate to all of this science that goes on without people really knowing what's going on. I'm flabbergasted at all that's going on with you guys right now that most of us don't know about.
Yeah, we're pretty busy. The council staff, we're working on lots of stuff. I'm working with international partners and our NOAA partners, and then we're also dealing directly with the fishermen and dealing with some of the community. So this time of year is a busy time of year. We have the Science and Statistical Committee. I'm leading a co-working group called the Spatial Working Group, which is we're developing what's called a roadmap to effective spatial management mm-hmm. in fisheries.
I know a lot of you have heard of spatial management. How does spatial management fit in to fisheries?
So here in Hawaii, in many regards. So, you know, spatial management can be anything from time area closures to mm-hmm. closing a fishery in a certain area, can be closing areas all the way mm-hmm. altogether. Coming up with the monument, for example, is a form of spatial management. Mm-hmm. And then also gear restrictions, capacity mm-hmm. limits mm-hmm. in fishing, anything has to do with any regional reallocation or limits on fishing effort.
And what I like about that is if you take a look at old Hawaii, we had a lot of that spatial management built into our society. I mean, there were certain times of the year, certain species, certain places where you couldn't fish. It may have sounded a bit backwards until you found out it was pretty accurate.
Yeah.
Back in old Hawaii, before things were written down, people sort of knew the rules. What, where to catch what and when and how much.
Yeah, it's a resource that's important for food security.
Yeah.
So you betcha folks are going to be very serious about it. And so for here in Hawaii, we've had some spatial management issues, like the monument that was put in place. So what we wanted to do and what we did at the last meeting in March is come up with recommendations, sort of what we call a roadmap to effective spatial management. We came up with six recommendations. These recommendations varied. Most of them are, okay, well, if you want to implement a spatial management measure, it doesn't need to be, it should not be capricious or arbitrary in nature. You need to have, what are your objectives? These objectives need to be, and we have three sets of objectives, a conservation benefit. Yep. You need to have that defined before you even open it. Social and economic benefit, and you also need to have some long-term performance metrics. Mm-hmm. How are you going to monitor?
I was going to say, isn't the biggest deal not necessarily coming up with the formula, but doing the monitoring?
Do you need to monitor?
I'm particularly concerned, and I want our listeners to be concerned, if we ever tap on them to go to their government representatives to fight for either allocation, reallocation, or continuance. Because I know a lot of you all in the science business, it costs money. And if there's no funding to pay for that, you have to move on to other areas. You can't just stay there if it's not paying for itself.
But when you do spatial management measures, you need to monitor based on performance metrics that are defined prior to implementation. Yeah. So it happens oftentimes, and I think it's even more precarious with highly migratory species than it is for like coral reef species or whatnot or have you, is folks will want to close an area off to fishing to a highly migratory species, which is very diffuse. They move around.
I said before, they don't know what grid they're in.
Right.
You know,
the fish aren't going to go hide under. Yeah. There's no, it's not like a reef structure.
Right.
Although, you know, fish do coral, I mean, not tunas and billfishes do have site fidelity, right? Mm-hmm. They do come to regions. But to the specificity of a grid that is closed off, that's an issue. And closing off an area to fishing without having objectives or performance metrics, often, A, it can create unwanted effects. Mm-hmm. You can actually be driving fishing effort into areas with more protected species interactions. Mm-hmm. There's also the crew safety, right? So fishermen have to travel further offshore. It puts them more at risk for safety at sea issues. More fuel costs, you know, that's got a carbon footprint with it, associated with it too, as well as cost. And there's so also the studies looking at the Indian Ocean. So the Indian Ocean, they had on the Chagos Archipelago, they looked at the implementation of marine protected areas and how did they relate to yellowfin tuna. And they found that in some cases it had a worse effect because all it did was displace fishing effort into smaller confined areas in the perimeter of the protected area.
Where they take everything.
And there's also enforcement issues too, the further you go.
Here's the other side of it. You've heard before many times on the program, and sometimes you can go to wpcouncil.org and see the results of these things. When we talk about when they close an area, or when they restrict areas, like all of these berths where you couldn't do the bottom fishing, it didn't necessarily prove out to be effective to the point where it may be, we got to open up some of these. But talk about the difficulty it is to change anything.
Yeah.
Once a decision has been made to open, to close, whatever, to turn that decision around, you better bring a lot of science to the table.
You do need to come to the table, and you need to come up. I mean, that's not to say, so what I want to be very clear for the listeners and anybody, is that spatial management is an effective tool.
Yeah.
It is a good tool. It can be very productive for both the resource, the fishery, and have economic, long-term economic gain. Mm-hmm. And so you need to do is to monitor these things and come up with objectives and metrics. And, you know, research has been shown, you know, I talked about the Indian Ocean. Well, one of our SSC members, Ray Hilborn, who's one of the
great guy.
Biggest, one of the biggest names in all fishery science, has found that when you start looking at highly mobile species, mm-hmm. the inherent effectiveness of spatial closures diminishes.
Yeah.
So if you're looking at coral reef species that may not move, and this lifetime displacement is a couple, you know, tens of kilometers, maybe, let's say, an opaca with, say, 100 mile, you know, maybe the lifetime displacement, then versus a tuna, which you're looking at thousands of miles of a lifetime displacement, the effectiveness, the efficacy of these spatial management measures diminishes. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when we start, there's also measures being pushed and through the United Nations right now, one called the Convention for the Conservation of Biodiversity Beyond National Jurisdiction. That's a mouthful, but it's called BB&J, and that is under UNCLOS, which is the United Nations Law of the Sea, which is a legally binding international.
It's an agreement.
Agreement.
And by the way, one of the most difficult things to achieve is that agreement in the first place.
There's a lot of positives. With these laws, however, you know, what there's a fear of is that possibly BB&J, which is, there's discussion of closing 30% of the high seas off the fishing. There's multiple issues that come to that may have negative consequences to the resource as well as the obvious to fisheries.
Yeah.
And so what happens is there's concern that this body may usurp our fisheries management organizations like the WCPFC, the IATTC, and the Atlantic ICAT, you've heard of, I'm sure.
Big time.
So there's a lot of issues there, and sort of, you know, while we don't want fisheries management organizations to have parochial interests that come before the resource, we also don't want to have heavy-handed and arbitrary and capricious measures that essentially inhibit sustainable fisheries.
You see, just by all of that stuff, Mark is saying, and you'd have to agree with this, everybody, that sometimes, yeah, you have to really look before you leap. Before you make a decision to close, open, or change any area, with the amount of science that's available now, caution to err on, to be a little short on pulling the trigger is better, because isn't it true it's very difficult to undo one of these?
It is very difficult to undo.
Even if it's the right thing to do, it's hard to do.
Yeah, one of the issues in the Western Central Pacific is that many of the waters of the areas within the W, more so than a lot of other parts of the world, is you have lots of EEZs, right? Mm-hmm, so EEZs are economic exclusion zones. So if you have an island, say, let's say if you're Tonga, you have 200 miles, nautical miles, from shoreline.
Right.
That is sovereign Tongan waters.
Right.
Same thing with America, Samoa.
Sure.
Same thing with Hawaii. Mm-hmm. Well, the United States has a very large EEZ. Much of it is closed to fishing. I think right now, like 60% of the EEZ, U.S. EEZ in the Pacific is closed. And so, you know, there's a higher reliance. There's more reliance of certain countries on the high seas. And when I mean the high seas, that are international waters.
Gotcha.
And so,
once again, this is a real enforcement challenge.
Yeah, and it's an enforcement challenge. And so when you fish the high seas, enforcement's an issue. But however, if you have electronic monitoring, observer coverage, just like we do here in the United States, you know, you can monitor and keep your eye, have more eyes on the water. Secondly, at the council meeting, we're going to have guests from Global Fishing Watch. So Tim White and David Kruzma and I have been discussing. They work for an organization called Global Fishing Watch. And so they use essentially satellite tracking data of vessels that are available.
Wow.
They also look at satellite imagery. Mm-hmm. So during the daytime, you can see vessels and then determine based on heading movements if they're fishing or not. Mm. And so it's a really fascinating, some may say, big brotherish tool.
Well, I got to tell you, though, I agree it is. But in many respects, it's needed. And I can tell you, being in Sean Martin and Jim Cook's office at POP, that they're able to electronically monitor their own boats.
Right.
They know where they are, what they're doing. They can tell what's going on. And that's not big brother. That's just efficiency.
It's efficiency and management.
Yeah, and it's management because...
And safety.
Yeah. One of the other things you were talking about earlier... And this may affect you folks listening that are weekend warriors. When you're trolling, every time you put another 10 miles into your day, you're putting your boat and your people and yourself at risk of not returning or running out of fuel. I know there's this one electric boat. They got an electric boat now, all electric. They say, no, this is great for the planet. No carbon footprint. Okay. But it has a 100 nautical mile range. So that's great unless you're catching fish 70 out and you go out 70 and you got to come in 70.
Yeah,
there's you know, you're going to get in trouble. So isn't it interesting that there can be a lot of good things coming out about this, but certainly being able to monitor things is a lot easier now with technology than it used to be.
It is, and you've got a lot of, and unfortunately, like you say, you know, one thing we wanted to say, we want to make very clear with monitoring, if you have a fishery that is voluntarily providing data and is monitored, it has a high rate of observer coverage. Yeah. And you're using that, oftentimes those who are reporting, we don't want this to be the norm. Mm-hmm. If you're reporting and you're playing by the rules, you don't want to be the first one on the chopping block when there are punitive measures
exactly
being made.
That's exactly what happens. It can happen.
And you've got a large fishery right now from China. They're increasing their fleet. You have 1,500 longliners operating in the Western Central Pacific from Taiwan. Mm-hmm. You know, you
1500,
have 1,500. Yeah. And although a lot of those boats are small scale, right? Mm-hmm. So they're fishing in South China Sea, right? But there's still a lot of fishing effort.
Well, even those, though, I got to tell you, much difficult than our fleets. A lot of those small boats have a mothership. I mean, it's not as though they got to travel 1,500 miles back with their catch. They can off their catch in the high seas sometimes.
They can. Yeah. They do have support carrier vessels, some of these fleets, but there's a distant water fleet too that will fish off north of the main Hawaiian Islands. So you've seen, I recommend going to Global Fishing Watch, playing around, and then looking at the main Hawaiian Islands, and then you can actually go with a tool. If you sign up, you can show which ones are from U.S. and from different fleets, and then show how many lights are lit up on that map off of north of the U.S. EEZ around the Northwest Hawaiian Islands. Yeah. The amount of fishing effort up there. And oftentimes, and very few of those foreign fleets have observers on them or have the level of reporting that we do.
Yeah, and a lack of consequences. You know, but here's the thing: you think that's monitoring? That's monitoring, but how much is it affecting? And I'll tell you, it's affecting an awful lot. It's like the Wild West. I mean, some of it seems to me like uncharted territory. There are restrictions and some sort of agreements, but very little monitoring, very little follow through, and very little consequences.
Yeah, and you know, there's an inherent economic interest, though, from a lot of these fishing countries on the same token to have best available data so they can make informed decisions because there's a lot of money in fishing, right?
You know,
so
there's another thing too, and one quick way you can, I don't know how much of this comes up at the meeting, I know it's never come up at the Fishers Forum to my knowledge, and that is that sometimes it is money. You got these fleets that are out there and they're doing everything they can to maximize their catch and maximize their income, but there are some people that are out there just to feed their people.
Right.
And it's hard to criticize somebody that's using their skill to feed people. I'm not talking about maybe profiteering. I'm talking about being able to take care of not just your family, but maybe your whole country.
Yeah.
Or your island, whatever.
And that is an issue, food security issue for a lot of Pacific Islands that people don't see. Well, I think the layperson doesn't understand the intrinsic value that fishing has for some of these island communities.
Yeah.
And it is, you know, we do need to take that into consideration. And also, like we were talking off the air, even here in Hawaii, we have a lot of folks here who they feed their family based on what they catch. People go and they go fishing here in Hawaii. Yeah. So it's not everybody goes to Safeway or Times or gets to go to Whole Foods, aka Whole Paycheck.
Yeah, or Wallet. I call it Whole Wallet.
Yeah. And go buy and go stock their fridge up with stuff. Folks do live off the water. So you have the individual, but also you have whole island communities who do that as well.
Yeah, and therein lies the issue. And that's why we hope that you got a little bit stimulated. And particularly if you've not been to a Fisher's Forum before, it's on the 25th at the Ala Moana Hotel between 6 and 8. It's free. You're invited to come and check it out. There's always some interesting display booths. There's going to be a really neat panel. Last time, Mark, we were talking earlier, it was sex.
Food, sex, and death.
And that got a lot of people came to the meeting and didn't expect what they got. But it is true. That's the three things on a fish's mind.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then this panel is going to be on technology, emerging technologies in fisheries. My colleague Tom Remington over at Council is putting this one together. Yeah. We have a friend of mine, Rahul Amin, from Pacific Islands Fishery Science Center, talking about a lot of the toys they have. Carl Jellings and Sons. We have Jim Horry talking about some fishing app. And then we have Tim White from Global Fishing Watch. He's going to be discussing
all of that. You can follow up on at wpcouncil.org.
See you there.
And if you want to hear something on the program, you can click a link on WP Council. You can also drop me an email, themikebuckshow@gmail.com. themikebuckshow@gmail.com. See you at the Fisher's Forum. Have a great week, everybody. I'll see you next time. Aloha.